You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my webpage at dr-history.com for over 440 true stories of the Old West. Also, now available on Amazon, my first book, a historical fiction based on true events entitled Coal Miner to Cowboy. The story of a young man born in England in 1850. He wants to be a cowboy and makes his way to America, travels from New Orleans to Independence on a steamboat, hires on as a teamster to Santa Fe, then on a cattle drive to Bozeman, Montana. He also rides shotgun on a stagecoach. He travels with a wagon train, and on his two-year journey, he meets some famous people and keeps a journal of his adventures. The book contains a lot of the true stories from my podcast and is now available on Amazon. Visit my webpage for a link to Amazon for the book, Coal Miner to Cowboy.
Bringing you now, Dr. History.
Good morning.
Jeff. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Sunny day today.
Did you enjoy our blizzard on Sunday?
You know, you wake up in the morning and everything's covered with snow. You know,
you get up later in the morning. I was at church.
Okay.
And I stepped out of church at, it was about, 10 after 11.
Yeah.
And I thought,
wow.
That's not what I thought.
Yep.
Woo, and the drive home on Highway 30, it was a little tacky out there.
A little slick.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we needed it. It's good.
Oh, it's wonderful.
It's
There you go. What are we going to talk about today?
Well, let me just say real quick, I heard from the Schnitzel over in Germany.
Verbal Budweiser Schnitzel. Yeah.
And he sent me, since we've been talking about Western films, last week, and we're going to do it this week again.
Good.
He sent me a song, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, that song done by an orchestra, and it was amazing to watch this, the singers, the musicians, and all that goes into that song of The Good and the Bad and the Ugly.
And you know who starred in that movie?
Clint Eastwood.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
It was one of the many spaghetti westerns.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So we're going to continue that train of thought. And so we talked last week that there was a point where we had these movies going, like The Great Train Robbery.
Yep.
But we needed a hero. So we're going to talk about some heroes.
Oh, good.
That came out of this whole thing.
All right.
So this ingredient was supplied by a sometime actor named Gilbert M. Anderson, who had appeared briefly as an extra in some films, and he actually took up directing himself, and in 1908, he headed to California to make westerns of his own. He ended up not only producing and directing, but also starring in his own films. Now, Anderson made a primitive, kind of sentimental little picture called Bronco Billy and the Baby.
Now, for some reason, I've heard of that.
Okay, well, so the public was delighted. They loved this. And Anderson gave them a sequel a week. Every week, he came up with a new one. Among them were Bronco Billy's Redemption.
Uh-oh.
Bronco Billy's Bible.
Uh-oh.
Bronco Billy's Oath. And Bronco Billy's Last Spree.
Oh, my goodness.
So for the next 7 years.
Now, these were all early films,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, just real short.
Yeah.
Very, very short. But for the next 7 years. So Bronco Billy Anderson was not handsome, nor capable of cowboy stunts, but he had a kind of a beefy, muscular look, kind of like you, you know.
No, thanks. Wait a minute. All right. He starts off this paragraph by saying he was not good looking and everything else, kind of like you. Thank you very much.
But
I appreciate
muscular.
The fact that you spent all these years here and this is the last program.
Okay, folks. Well, we're going to make it good.
Okay.
Well, eventually. He learned how to twirl a lariat. He finally learned how to sit on a horse and act like he wasn't falling off. Anyway, his pictures were kind of clumsy adaptations of actually from the old pulp stories, the old dime novels.
Yeah.
It was kind of a takeoff from those, but in film. And the it went for, at that time they called it two reels, which was about a half an hour. Mm-hmm. That was the length. And cost about $800 to produce, but they proved themselves a saleable item, and they each one grossed about $50,000.
Now, did they ship those after they were finalized to various movie theaters?
Yeah, all over the country. So they would go out to all these theaters all across the country and in these two, you know, these metal boxes that they had with the reels in them.
Yeah.
And $800 to produce and $50,000.
I'd say old Bronco Billy got rich.
He did all right. Now, other companies followed and went west to take root beneath the Southern California sun. Westerns got bigger budgets, longer running. Eventually, they got up to seven or eight reels, which would be, you know, hour and a half, you know. And larger, they got to be larger and larger. And filmmakers like a guy named David Griffin, he utilized realistic scenic locations and added excitement by employing daredevil riders who performed dangerous stunts during these chases and battle scenes. And we talked a little about that last week, about the horses that would go down and the cowboys. But Griffith played a curious role in the enhancement of the Western. He made a lot of them between 1908 and 1913. That's over 100 years ago, Zeb.
Wow. Are any of those films still available?
You know, I wondered if those would be somehow available.
I wonder if they took caution and treated the film itself somehow.
I don't know. I know that after a while they disintegrate.
Disintegrate.
So, but he enjoyed...
That's true. With a lot of movies today, they should disintegrate.
That's true. But he did a lot of outdoor action, and he produced several among them. One was, and I haven't heard of this, maybe you have, The Goddess of Sagebrush Gulch, The Last Drop of Water, and Fighting Blood, and they were remarkable for their day. So another guy named Thomas Ince, and this is in 1913, he developed an organization that turned out a picture a week, and that's quite a bit.
Yeah. Okay?
Mainly Westerns, both features and shorts, and he, in many respects, the kind of the model for the big studio operations of the future.
Did they have a cast of people?
Yeah. And just, again, just kind of the beginnings of all this. So this Tom and Ince went to Los Angeles in 1911. The studio that he went to turned out to be an abandoned grocery store converted into a makeshift film processing laboratory with the backyard stage that boasted a single backdrop showing birds in flight. They only had one backdrop.
Really?
For all the movies.
All the movies.
Yeah. Now, here's where it gets a little more interesting. He discovered the Miller Brothers 101 Ranch Wild West Show. And you've heard of those, probably.
Yeah.
And they were at winter quarters near Los Angeles. And so he rented the whole operation for $2,500 a week. And so already he had himself cowboys, Indians, cattle, stagecoaches, horses, buffalo.
And where did they do this? On location or take it to?
Yeah, he then bought 14,000 acres of landscape in the hills north of Santa Monica.
Can you imagine what that's worth today?
Oh, gosh. And so, and this is where he set up his studio and started making films. There's one called War on the Plains, The Battle of the Red Men, The Indian Massacre, The Lieutenant's Last Fight. And all of these were filmed at this location, this 14,000 acre area, which he had, like, say, the Miller Brothers 101 Ranch as the extras. So he had all the horses, the stagecoaches, everything he needed.
Right there on his ranch.
Yeah, on this place. So really, he had really a heads up on the film industry. So at this point, he had a decision to let a middle-aged actor, and you're going to remember this one, named William Surrey Hart.
Oh, Bill Hart.
He experimented at playing a reformed outlaw in two pictures and to give him his lead thereafter. So William S. Hart.
Yeah, there you go.
Bill Hart, an Easterner. He played Shakespeare. He came to Western movies with a kind of a genuine mission. He had seen a number of Western movies and he was kind of outraged at the historical license that their fantasies had taken some of the movies, which has that's taken place even in our modern day, a little literary license.
Yeah, in other words, they cheat on history.
Yeah, and you and I know, we've talked about this, we want it to be historically accurate.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Anyway, so he settled in the West, and this cheerful cowboy persisted, and he became kind of the incubator of guys like Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, and other singing cowboys. But Hart established a tradition of authenticity, and there was an epic movie called The Covered Wagon, another one called The Iron Horse, and later even big budget westerns that he was.
Where do you think, and I've often wondered this, where do you think that it was all of a sudden publicly acceptable to have a singing cowboy? Who started that?
Good. Gene Autry,
yeah,
Roy Rogers.
Yeah, but I mean, really, all the guys that I know in the rodeo, don't want them singing. No way.
Well, so Hart, he saw, when he was a boy, he saw great herds of Texas cattle being driven to the railheads, and he actually learned to speak the Sioux language while playing with Indian children on the frontier.
Really?
And his family moved east in the 1880s, but he still thought of himself as a, quote, white Indian boy. So he was kind of a rugged individual.
William S. Hart.
Yeah. So he studied acting briefly in England after working his way across the Atlantic, and when he came back to the United States, he actually played Shakespeare for a while, but he...
Well, now, there's an interesting combination.
From Shakespeare to the West.
Wow.
But he became a celebrated, eventually as an interpreter of Western roles, and had starred in a succession of plays, including The Squaw Man, The Virginian, The Trail of the Lonesome Pine, and he saw his first Western movie and became obsessed with creating motion pictures of his own.
Did any of them know how to ride?
Some did. The extras, obviously.
Yeah.
The stuntmen. Yeah. We know they did.
Yeah.
But this guy named Thomas Ince, he was less than enthusiastic when Hart arrived in Los Angeles in 1913. He was not convinced, in spite of his own success, that Westerns had any commercial future. He didn't think they would last.
Really?
But, and he didn't see how Hart, by now he's 43 years old, would keep customers coming to the box office.
Uh-huh.
And, by 43, that's considered probably past your prime.
Boy, where am I?
Yeah, and I. So, but this guy named Thomas Ince, he was riding high and he could afford to take a chance on this Hart guy, whom he'd known in New York. And so the producer let Hart play the villain in two short movies, and with these completed, allowed him to help write his own lead role in two feature films, The Bargain and On the Night Stage, those two movies. Hart left for New York thereafter, apparently feeling that he'd done his bit to rescue Hollywood from himself. And Ince soon discovered, however, that the movie, The Bargain, that he'd made was a smash hit.
Really?
So he got a hold of Hart, offered him a contract at the exorbitant fee of $125 a week.
That's what he got paid?
$125.
Wow.
This is what, 1911?
Oh, yeah. My goodness.
Well,
sakes.
Hart accepted. He didn't know about the picture's success and later grew a little bit bitter of being forced to work for such a modest wage. But he did persuade Ince to give him full control of every picture he made, and eventually escaped the contract of $125.
Mm.
And his unique approach to Westerns proved so popular that when he died in 1946, he left an estate of $1 million.
No kidding.
So eventually he did get paid.
This is William S. Hart.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Hart was a tall, lean man, high cheekbones, piercing eyes. He seemed younger than he was. you know, he had these features that gave him kind of a menacing, kind of a
sinister.
Yeah, sinister look, you know. But he dressed himself and his fellow actors in exactly the sort of worn clothing that he remembered from Kansas in the days of the cattle drives. And his sets had the look of the shabby settlements that still existed in many parts of the West. So
the realism.
Yeah, he insisted on historical accuracy. So anyway, but Hart's film succeeded in creating the look of the Old West. He kind of embellished the melodrama, you know, like the cattle towns that he'd experienced. He began casting himself as wait a minute. I missed a page.
Ladies and gentlemen, the delay on the air is because Dr. History has lost his place.
So he began showing himself as a, quote, good bad man.
I see.
And who was moved to redemption by the love of a virtuous woman. And he stuck to his formula, similar to Bronco Billy in practically all the pictures that he made.
So they were the trendsetters of the John Waynes and everybody else.
Exactly. Yeah. So the next guy we're going to talk about, Thomas Edwin Mix.
Oh, now I can tell you stories about Tom.
Tom Mix.
Yep.
So he'd long since taken over as the movie's preeminent cowboy star by selling flamboyant showmanship rather than Hart's kind of dusty authenticity.
What was the year that he came into prominence? It was in the early 20s,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Around 1926.
26, yeah.
So let me show you a picture of him.
Yeah.
You know, the white hat, white.
Yeah, I mean, he was dressed to the nines.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm sure you could wear that out on a ranch, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Branding time.
Yeah, yeah. So, but he inspired a whole bunch of white-hatted cowboy heroes and 1,000 Formula B Westerns and kept himself in the public eye for years after Hart was kind of forgotten, unfortunately. So Tom Mix, like Hart, he built his horse as a co-star. But while Hart retired his mount, a horse named Fritz, early in his career, Mix's trick horse named Tony became the best-known animal in show business until Rin Tin Tin appeared.
Really?
Folks, you know Rin Tin Tin, right?
Oh, yeah.
The dog?
Corporal Rusty.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And again, like Hart, Mix directed his own early pictures, but Mix indulged in an appetite for outrageous stunts that made his movies far less predictable than those of his fading rival.
Now, did he do the stunt work or hire it?
Both. He did a little both. But he came equipped, in fact, with a talent for exaggerating the truth.
I see.
He not only built himself as America's champion cowboy, which is questionable, but invented a collection of biographical data that is also questionable.
So in other words, he wrote his resume.
He did, and his biography.
Yes.
There's a good many versions of his life story. Mix claimed at one time or another to have been born in a log cabin in Texas. No, he wasn't.
Yeah.
Supposedly his father was an officer in the cavalry. Supposedly his mother was a Cherokee Indian woman. Supposedly joined the Texas Rangers. He was a scout, wounded in action, taking part in the Boxer Rebellion and the Philippine War, going to Africa to break horses for the British Army, a guide for Theodore Roosevelt.
Well, let me ask you a question, and this is a serious question, too. Wasn't he a friend, a close friend, of the real life of Wyatt Earp?
You know, I don't know that. I think
he was. And when Wyatt Earp died in California, I think he was one of the speakers at the funeral.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that.
Yeah, I don't have that in my notes here. Yeah. But anyway, he went on and on about his the many wonderful things he did, which mostly was not true. So, I mean, barely escaping a firing squad.
Okay.
I mean, excelling in rodeos before he became famous in Hollywood. Mix was a good athlete. He rode well enough to do his own stunts, having learned to handle horses as a boy from his Teamster father. He had also been both a soldier and a performer in Wild West shows, but he'd been born and raised in Pennsylvania, not Texas.
Oh, boy, cowboy country.
Yeah. There's no evidence that he saw any action after joining, and he did join the Army, but he deserted the Army and headed for Oklahoma.
Oh, my.
And got a job attending bar, and he was to spend quite a bit of money on two or more wives.
I see.
His dream of becoming a latter-day Buffalo Bill, he managed a job as a writer with the 101 Ranch Wild West show, and he was working as a deputy marshal in Dewey in 1909 when a crew came to shoot to town to shoot a documentary on ranching. Well, Mix hired on as a handler of livestock, appeared in a bronc busting sequence and stayed with the crew as they traveled about the West, and he starred in a couple of fictional Western movies and later went to California. And Mix, almost 100 of these little movies over the following 8 years, learned his trade well. He was paid to produce and direct as well as rope and ride. And anyway, that's when an operator named William Fox hired him to make feature films in 1917, and he became an instant sensation.
You know, we got to wrap this up, but I'd like to continue this from this point on to the inception of Gene Autry and Roy Rogers and all those others. Can you do that next week?
Yeah, I can. Let me just finish Mix real quick.
Okay, I got about a minute.
Okay, so he did go on. He pulled his guns only to – he never killed anybody. He preferred fist fights. He fought on top of freight cars on the edges of cliffs.
He preferred that?
Yeah. But, you know, he was kind of a low – no violence, so to speak.
I see.
Shooting or killing people.
Okay.
But he was in over 300 motion pictures, a lot of B-movies. Anyway, so that's kind of how
When was the last that he appeared on the silver screen? Do you have that?
He was still a star in 1940.
Yeah.
And actually, this is the end. He had a tendency to like fast cars. 1940, he took a curve too fast in one of his fancy cars, died of a broken neck near Florence, Arizona.
There you go. Oh, really? Florence, Arizona?
That was the end of Tom Mix.
You know, I want to get into more of this with you because it's really interesting and fascinating. Real quick, I want to say that a lot of the Hollywood actors that wanted to be would-be or want-to-be cowboys, they took riding lessons from a friend of mine that's passed away since, but I knew him very well, Don Burt. In California.
Okay.
He gave riding lessons to the stars so they could appear somewhat knowledgeable in these movies.
It's always amazed me to see, you know, you see some cowboys, you know good and well they're not on a horse.
Oh, you got that right. But this is really interesting. Let's do this again next week.
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. History.